Hello and welcome to the next episode of Transperfect Lifestyle Talks. I'm Mark Wade, I'm the practice leader here at Transperfect, and I'm joined today by Dr. Carl McAvoy. Carl is the VP of ECOA and Patient Technology at Y-Prime and his PhD from UCD. Now, two Irish guys, both from Dublin, so we're going to concentrate on speaking slowly because and our accents, try to keep our accents as normal as possible, but I can just feel, Carl, that we're going to slip into the whole thing in a moment. There you go. Okay.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
Now, thanks for joining us today. I want to just jump right in. This podcast, it's going to be a dense kind of thing, but let's jump right in because we've talked many times around like study design, translation, localization, migrating to ECOA. But one of the things, interestingly enough, is that we wanted to talk about the evolution of how studies are much more patient-centric. We know the FDA are very focused on that. And you had a couple of interesting ideas around how patient-centric and how patients are getting their hands involved in the study. So could I ask you to begin us off on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And thanks again for having me, Mark. I'll try and keep in mind the speed at which I speak. It's very easy. Yeah, so I think for me, it's been an interesting journey. You know, if we take a sort of a helicopter view of things, you look back to when, you know, clinical trials started to involve the patient voice, when we started to look at COAs from the patient perspective rather than clinician focused. And we think about how we started to see the FDA asking for what was important to the patient, looking for involvement in at least asking them directly about their symptoms rather than a clinician telling us how they interpret the patient's symptoms. And I think when we fast forward maybe about 20 years and we get to now, we think actually we're seeing it completely almost 360, where patients are as informed as clinicians, partly because of the internet, partly because of really good patient advocacy groups, and partly just because I think the nature of how we work with clinicians and work within healthcare has changed. And there's a whole piece in the middle of just the evolution of PROs, involving patients in designing PROs, involving them in protocols, but actually now involving them more and more in drug development. And I'd love to unpack some of that today because I think there's a huge amount we could cover.
So in real terms though, right, in real terms, what are patients doing? It's not just they're going into the PI site and saying blank, blank, blank. They actually are getting their hands involved. I've seen this in my work. I've seen them get involved in advocacy groups. And in that way, it has been problematic. Do you see that?
A little bit. So I should probably quantify by saying that I've worked with a couple of different ECOA providers over the years, but I've also worked on the pharmaceutical side. I won't name names just for the sake of the recording, but I've sort of seen both sides. I think there's a real power in having patients involved. An organization I know of have a red chair in every meeting room. Oh, yeah. And the idea is if you get stuck on a concept, if you're having a bit of a back and forth with your colleagues about budget, about the color of a logo, about the branding of something, about maybe what scales you're going to include in your strategy. The concept is that you look at the chair and you are reminded that that empty chair represents a patient who's waiting for a novel treatment, and that we should get unstuck because if a patient was sitting there hearing this almost trivial conversation sometimes, we would start to think maybe differently. So I think that's a good example of where we're seeing that patient involvement sort of early on, and that's evolved. So I think that's a very solid piece of where it can work well at a kind of a high level within a pharma company. I think where it starts to go the other way is maybe an example you and I spoke about before at a conference where we were talking about unblinding in certain trials where patient groups are so closely knit, rare diseases in particular. People go online, people talk, people start to realize maybe they're on a placebo, maybe they're not getting the treatment or seeing the desired effect. So I think there's a power to it, but I also think that with everything, it needs to be used responsibly. And I think that's partly down to study design, but also how you engage those advocacy groups. You know, there's a way of getting to meet these individuals. There's a way of onboarding them to your protocol. There's a way of involving them in actually creating the study design, which I think will help to then maybe address in advance any of that issue that might come from people oversharing.
I think there are certain TAs that the patients are far more motivated. I think it's a great example. And I worked on one of those studies where the patients were so motivated that their support network was a constant backwards and forwards of data. And they were sharing almost too much information. And then Johnny works out that Mary is on this particular study and she's in the cell. Oh, you're in the same city as I am. And it became very problematic because data was a bit too close to the bone. But then there are other TAs where if they're asymptomatic, it's very pedestrian in many ways. Have you ever had that kind of experience? I think some like high hypertension, things like that, because they're asymptomatic for the most part, these patients aren't motivated to share that experience.
Yeah, I did some research a long time ago in diabetes, and we found that there were patients who were sneaking away to bathrooms to inject their insulin or to take their blood glucose measurements. Now, This was about 10 years ago, maybe a bit longer. And we were horrified sitting in the room doing these patient advocacy meetings to hear that people were, there was a taboo. A couple of people mentioned that, particularly as a kid or as a teenager, people were commenting on the fact that they were looking for attention by sort of dosing themselves in a school restaurant or cafeteria. And certain people with, you know, from certain ethnic backgrounds or religious beliefs, there's a kind of a stigma attached to having health conditions. So sneaking away to do something in private where actually that's not a problem for people, you know, you should be able to look after your own healthcare. So I think in those scenarios, you see people almost taking a backseat and not sharing because they maybe don't want to share the fact that they have a condition. But then in other conditions, we see like rare diseases with children. We see parents, particularly parents, caregivers, being so clued in that they go toe-to-toe with academics at conferences. So you'll see them stood around poster sessions, you'll see them run back and forth. And it's quite incredible, you know. And maybe just to name drop another Irishman, since there's two of us here, Colin Farrell has a son.
Did you see that? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so he's a big advocate, obviously, for Angelman's. But you and I know somebody who has worked in that condition. Yeah. And met him at a conference and he sort of leaned in slightly menacingly, you know, I said, you better hurry up and find a cure. You see everything. You see famous people giving their power to charities. You see parents who are really well educated and as academically well up as the clinicians. And so they're really pushing each other. I think patients who don't have a voice and can't advocate for themselves often have their caregivers doing it.
Yeah.
And for parents who have children with really severe needs like that, it often becomes their full-time job. So you'll find one parent is maybe working and looking after the financial side of things, and the other parent is the full-time caregiver supporting that child's needs. So a lot of what they do within the advocacy groups is sharing information. It's upskilling almost. It's sharing their experience, what it's like to live with the condition, look after people with the condition, but actually reading journals, seeing what drugs are out there. If you've got no treatment whatsoever for a rare condition, every publication that's maybe a little bit closer is worth your while reading. These groups are pushing the clinicians. And I think as a result, the clinicians, because they're feeling a little challenged at some of these conferences, are having to up their game too, because they have to be able to fire back. You know, they have to be able to respond like they would talking to a colleague. I think that dynamic of sort of old stereotypical walking into a doctor's office, you would be maybe not so well educated. You're working and you're sitting there with somebody in a position of power and you're listening to everything they say because doctors are never wrong. But now I think patients, because of the information available, and it's not always the case, right? Sometimes you go to Dr. Google and you come back with all sorts of conditions that, you know, you couldn't possibly have. But I think because patients are so well informed, when it works well, it works really well. But again, it's about balance.
I think there's two sides to that. There's the one side where you have the people going onto WebMD and sites like that, and they're trying to diagnose themselves with virtually no data. Really, they're the ones that concern me. Then you have the other ones which really impressed me. I was at a conference a while ago, I think you actually might have been there, and there was a lecture on Duchenne's, and there was the advocacy group, and there was this mother, and she was genuinely staggeringly strong, she's brilliant, but she was the one who was pushing all the ECOA providers saying, what you're doing is not good enough. You're capturing things in instruments and questionnaires. So let's get video and let's try and interpret that. And I remember this a few years ago, and I'm thinking, this is brilliant. So that's exactly what you're talking about. This real advocacy for the patient.
Did you know I worked on that project?
I didn't know you worked on that project.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Again, I shouldn't mention names, but that lady has an incredible story. So her son has been in a couple of different trials. And from what I recall, the drive for her setting up this company that creates and takes these video assessments was that her son was put onto a drug that was having a positive effect on him. Mm-hmm. And she was videoing him at home to show the change over time.
Videos I saw,
mad for football, soccer, for our friends across the Atlantic. And for her, it was videoing him getting in and out of their family station wagon and how he would use compensatory movements to get in and out to eventually him actually sort of skipping into the car almost. It was incredible. But the insurance provider in the US wouldn't cover the medication for her. So she sent the videos. And in under 24 hours, the CEO of that provider turned their decision around and actually reimbursed them for the drug. So it's quite incredible. But that is a classic example of where we see scales that are maybe not at all adequate. Now, that study, to be fair, and to call it out, the videos were created with a provider who is known to everybody, I would say, who's watching this webinar, who does a lot of really excellent
work. Who might have been on this very podcast at some point.
And so we looked at getting physiotherapists to rate the videos, to look at the compensatory movements, to essentially replicate at home activities children were doing at the site. And the idea being, you're not getting your best self. Patient showing up after 4 or 5 hours of travel to a site, particularly a child, isn't focused mentally or physically. They're fatigued both ways. And to have them do an assessment where they have to climb some stairs and stand to attention, they're not physically or mentally there, having traveled so much. And that's a burden for children who don't have a condition. So with all of the stuff that has to go with traveling for a child who has unique needs, I think it makes it even more difficult. So the videos were assessed by different physiotherapists. There was a third physiotherapist who would essentially look at the two scores to make sure there was an agreement if there was any misalignment, and that was validated versus a traditional score. But it's been quite incredible to see how well that's worked. And one of the reasons, because I've seen this at other conferences in other TAs, is the fact that you ask children to do something in a clinic that they wouldn't normally do at home, and so it's alien to them. Sure. It's like that old racetrack analogy. You create drugs in this really enclosed area to make them work as best they can on a dry track with no other traffic. You put the drug into the real world and you're sitting in traffic. It was like a Ferrari on a test track versus sitting in morning rush hour. You're traveling just as quick as everybody else. Mm-hmm. And so for that reason, they looked at doing these video assessments to essentially move away from old, repetitive, out of context scales. And part of that is things like ambulation. A lot of children with rare diseases might lose ambulatory ability. And yet clinicians still ask them at the first question of every visit, is your child ambulatory? That upsets patients and upsets parents, because if they haven't walked in 6 months, they're definitely not walking next month. It's repetition and sort of outdated scales, I think, to a degree, or maybe just not adapting enough.
That's exactly it. It's not adapting. And that's why I come back to the point, it's great to have patients involved and maybe patients having an input into the actual instruments that we create. I mean, I don't know how you feel about that, but I mean, that right now we have very specific persons who create these instruments. They're stress tested, the science for these stress tested, wonderful instruments. But it's great to have patients actually getting involved and helping us, because like you say, that's real world. That's a Ferrari in traffic. Do you ever come across where you've had patients actually directly inputting the creation of an instrument? I suppose that study you talked about. Besides that one study, have you seen it, or is that an anomaly?
Yeah, I've seen it a couple of times. Actually, I won't name names, but there's an Irish lady who's very prolific in the field of Parkinson's, and she created her own application based on the fact that she felt a lot of the scales weren't meeting her needs. And this is something we hear in Parkinson's quite a lot, where patients are being asked about things like their ability to play golf. Now, I remember a patient's as partnerships conference in London earlier in the year, a lady from Barcelona who had a couple of kids and was quite young to have Parkinson's. And she said, why is this questionnaire asking me about my ability to play golf? We haven't had much rain in Barcelona in the last few years. We're not exactly known for our golf courses, and I've got kids. So it's not my Parkinson's that's stopping me from playing golf. It's the fact that I just couldn't. I just wouldn't have time. There's not a location. So if I say yes to the fact that I can't play golf, it's not because your Parkinson's is stopping you. It's because the question isn't geared up properly. So there's lots of weird examples where questions don't quite work. And I think, again, that's a reason why we see patient groups creating their scales. We hear quite a bit, particularly in rare diseases, where patients see scales that are really outdated, sometimes culturally not adapted very well either. But asking about activities that in this sort of stereotypical TV world of 1950s clinician, you know, white coat, beard, you know, golf, weird activities that maybe don't happen in everyday life. And things change, right? Like using a typewriter comes up quite a lot in questionnaires. And particularly if you're looking at limb function or you're looking at dexterity and people are asking you, can you type letters to friends? And you're like, well, I probably could, but I'm not using a typewriter. So that physical action of like clunking keys is very different to using a keyboard on a screen or just a keyboard on a laptop or a PC. So I think for that reason, we see patients looking to develop scales that are more applicable to themselves. There's definitely one or two examples in MS. I actually think there's even a biotech.
Oncology is a great example. Yeah.
Mm. We've even seen biotech set up by patients.
This could be controversial. We could get killed for this one. But a lot of these instruments, I call them legacy instruments, right? A lot of these measures are, as you rightly say, they were a few years old and they might not be fit for purpose today. They might be a scattergun versus a rifle. You know, what do we do? Should we retire these instruments, these legacy instruments? Like I said, we could get panned. Yeah, yeah. What should we do?
Well, I guess, so there's two things. I think one, I completely agree. There's definitely a broader sort of scattergun approach to things historically. I don't think that's anybody's fault per se. I just think the measurement science was different back then. the field of measurement science hadn't evolved to where it is now. So I think, as I said earlier, you know, you have this sort of power dynamic. A doctor is the smartest person in the village kind of thing. They see 100 patients a day. They know everybody. The patient goes in, they do exactly what the doctor says. And it's this old sort of stereotypic relationship. Whereas now it's very different for lots of reasons. But I think back then scales were essentially created by clinicians who were experts in their field or at that stage knew as much as anyone could know about a particular disease. So we were looking at things in a very sort of objective way. Mm-hmm. And before we started to introduce the subjective and the patient side of things, I think those scales just got established. You know, if your competitor gets a label claim based on a drug that, or based on a scale that was developed in the 70s, and then you have to release a drug which you feel works better than that competitor, but you need to highlight that, you need to show it. Well, basically, you got to compare apples to apples. So you end up using that same scale. So I think these legacy scales remain in play because people have to compare a drug to another drug. And the best way to measure it is to measure it with the same scale. So I think there's a little bit of that. But to your question, should we scrap them? I would say yes, insofar as it's probably easier to develop a new questionnaire than to try and sand or mold an old questionnaire into something. I think it becomes a very good starting point. And I think you'll end up with like an evolved version of that same scale. But arguably, you know, statistical methods have moved on, methods for research have moved on, patients themselves have moved on. What we do in terms of activities of daily living even is very different. We're not getting up to cross a room to change channel on a TV. We're probably not even using a TV, right? We could be using projectors, we could be using devices in our lap. So the whole concept of what we measure and how, I think, is very different. And healthcare has changed. Patients are getting older. What we would consider elderly when you and I were kids is not at all, or maybe that's just because we're getting older ourselves. We don't want to admit it. I don't know. But I think we're seeing patients even changing how they live and how long they live. So scales that were developed for certain patient cohorts, I think, need to evolve anyway.
But to your point, if a scale has been used forever and there's been so many compounds being brought to market based on that data, it's very difficult to move away from that. I mean, and there are certain regulatory bodies, I don't want to mention ones, but there is one particular regulatory body that virtually insists on one instrument, one general well-being measure being used. And one could argue that it's very much a scattergun approach. It's a general well-being measure, but this regulatory body almost in writing says we should be using it. And I find that challenging. Because there are so many more, and we talked about this before, but it's like, if you look at certain studies, certain protocols, I know we're cognizant of time, but I hope we have time for this. But you know, in certain protocols, and we look at the number of instruments that have been added onto this, two things come to mind. I want your opinion on this. Two things come to mind. One is, when were the instruments decided upon? Were they decided in the study design or were they decided later on? And the second thing is, at what point is it too much of a burden for the patients? If we put three instruments with an average of 80 items, is that too much? And also, I know it depends on the TA also. So I don't know. I find it very frustrating. I'm very cognizant of time. Give us your thoughts on that one.
So for design, I think it's a combination of both. I've seen protocols come to me as an eCOA provider, and I've seen me send protocols to eCOA providers, depending on which side of the fence I've been on. And often draft becomes draft two, becomes draft three. And actually FPI pushes out a little bit because maybe a PCOR scientist and a clinical scientist can't agree on what the exact measurement strategy should be. Sometimes that's the academic sort of argument of what are we trying to measure, or one academic feeling their choice is better than another's. Sometimes it is genuinely looking at what is best for the patients. We might remove a scale, replace it with something else because we don't want to duplicate what we're asking patients. We want to hone in on certain things. I think it comes from a good place. But I agree, we need to stop it. It does happen from design right through to go live. And I've seen scales change really last minute. How much is too much is a good example, or a good question, should I say. I hear this anecdote a lot of 100 items per oncology patient in a study. Again, without giving names away, I know of at least one pharma company who will use those same three or four very famous scales that I use in oncology studies. But when patients get to a point where we know they're not responding to the drug, where they're going to be end of life, people will cut down the number of visits. They'll also cut down the number of items they're being asked. So you can be quite targeted in what you do. You can start to specifically probe the domains that are of interest to you, maybe if you're a primary or your secondary endpoint, or maybe quality of life driven, but focusing them in on what is most relevant to patients who are end of life. So it is a tricky one because those patients have given a lot of time and effort in their last days or months or years. So we do, it sounds a bit cold, but we do need to continue to collect data from them because we don't want to waste what we've collected. We don't want their sacrifice or their sharing their knowledge to sort of not be included in what we're collecting. But equally, we don't want to overburden them at a point where they've got a huge amount going on, and being part of a clinical trial that they've not done well in is definitely the last thing on their mind. So we do see it. We see people getting certain domains removed from scales and thinking about that very early on, where you might have a different treatment arm or a different schedule of assessments based on where the patient is within the trial.
I wonder, and I'll finish on this point, I wonder, is that very oncology specific because the endpoint is quite finite?
Yeah, well, mostly. I think mostly. And that's, in my own experience, probably because I've worked on a lot of oncology studies. But I have seen it in things like Alzheimer's. I've seen it in things like Huntington's, where, you know, sometimes patients aren't clinically diagnosed, say, with something like Alzheimer's. So we're probably asking them more scales. And then as they get a diagnosis or as their disease progresses, we start to switch and we see caregiver scales. Likewise, if we're talking about limb function, dexterity, motor movement, all of that kind of stuff that you'll see in neurological conditions, again, we start to switch off a little. We start to think about what is relevant for the patient at the time they are. And I think that's partly down to study design. I think we're getting better as an industry at just being sensible about these things and not collecting everything for the sake of collecting everything. Some of it's to do with scales getting better. Part of it, I think, is digital measurement, having DHTs or sensors, wearables, you know, almost passively detecting some of the stuff that we would have asked about. So you can be looking at activity, you can be looking at tremor without necessarily asking about it. In some cases, we're not quite there yet. We're still validating these things versus old paper scales. But I think we'll get to a point where some of the noise will sort of go away. We'll be passively collecting a lot of information from patients in every condition, at every point in the trial, even if we're not necessarily asking them specific PROs or asking them less.
I got it. Carl, thank you so much. I also want to congratulate you, by the way. My tenure as co-director industry for CPATH ends in December, and our new co-director is going to be Dr. Carl McAvoy. So congratulations. I pass the mic to you.
Thank you very much.
All the crazy amount of work that you're going to have to do now, so best of luck.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you so much for coming out today. I appreciate it. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe. You'll find it on everywhere you get your podcast. And if you wanted to come on the podcast yourselves, drop me a line, mwaythetransperfect.com. Until I see you next time. Thanks. Bye-bye.